Caesar. Julius Caesar. With Ray and Cap. Caesar was a vampire. Don't make me pull a Sulla. Life of Caesar.
Okay, Big Daddy Ray's back. Go for Big Daddy Ray.
Welcome back to The Life of Caesar, episode 38.
Woo!
In our last episode, Ray nearly died in a car accident.
Not of my fault this time.
And disclosed his alcoholism.
The first step is admitting you have a problem.
Yes.
Yes.
So, at the end of the last episode, Caesar had celebrated his 40 days of public thanksgiving, his four triumphs. Cleopatra had been to Rome. Cicero's feelings were hurt because Cleopatra didn't give a fuck who he was. And on
a low note, 400 lions, some elephants, and some giraffes were slaughtered.
Even while all this was going on, Caesar getting down to business.
Getting down to business.
Hold on. I just had an idea.
My theme song. Oh, yeah.
Girl. Tonight we're going to make love. You know how I know?
Caesar
because
love.
It's Wednesday. And Wednesday night is the night that we usually make love. Monday night is my night to cook. Tuesday night we go and visit your mother. But Wednesday we make sweet weekly love. It's when everything is just right. There's nothing good on TV. You haven't had your after work social sports team practice, so you're not too tired.
Just right.
It's all on. You lean in and whisper something sexy in my ear like,
I might go to bed now, I've got work in the morning.
I know what you're trying to say, girl. You're trying to say, oh yeah. It's business time. It's business time.
It's business time.
Time, baby.
That's right. And can I say, just my wife is a huge fan of Caesar. So the month of July, all the sex I want, anytime, anywhere, and the rest of the year, not so much. But anyway, I love July. I'm looking forward to every July. It's a complicated marriage. It's a complicated
marriage. What the fuck are you talking about? But okay.
July?
Yeah, but what's that got to do with that song or anything that we're talking about?
Just, I said this last time, I'll say it again.
You're so fucking drunk by this stage. And the PTSD has kicked in from your near fatal car accident. You're just rambling.
I almost died. Anyway.
Caesar's getting down to the businesses of governing, as you would expect, even while everyone else is partying.
Yeah, he's looking down.
Literally. People were getting upset. Because he was reading and dictating letters during the games. Yeah. The gladiators gladiators are fighting. They're killing elephants and lions and giraffes. And he's dictating letters. Because, Caesar, he doesn't have a lot of time for a start. Yeah. And he's a serious man.
I mean, just picture, two gladiators. One knocks the other one down. He puts his foot on his chest. He's about to stab him through the throat. He looks up at Caesar and goes, "What should I do, Lord?" "What? What should I do, Lord?" "I don't know. You decide. I'm busy. Delegate. You do it." "Fuck, I don't know. I've never had to decide before." So, just ruining the mood. He's killing the mood.
Yeah. I mean, to put this in perspective, he gets back to Rome in July 46.
Mm-hmm.
And 4 months later, he goes back to Spain.
Right.
And then, without wanting to ruin anything, he's assassinated in March of 44. So, and they only have 10 months of the year. Oh, no, he had some months, which we'll talk about. But it's he doesn't have a lot of time. And the scale of what he actually gets done in terms of the political reforms, particularly when you take into account that he's only there for 4 months before he takes off again, is amazing. Like, this is...
Yeah.
This is like, you know, if Obama had become president in 2008 and then actually done something in his first 4 months, like, it'd be amazing, right. You know?
Yeah. Now, let me give it some framework, because I think I read it a little, or I interpreted it a little differently in my book. So he gets back in July of 46. He's going to be heading out in November of 46. He's not going to come back until the summer of 45. And so, and then he comes back in the rest of 45 and 44. He's either consul slash dictator. He's some position he's in charge. And so all the reforms that we're going to talk about somehow either got started or got done, whatever, between when he came back in July, you know, had all his partying, and sometime in 44 when he's killed. But keep in mind that for like Cam was saying, he's going to be gone from fall of 46 until the summer of 45. So the fact that he got all this stuff done is even more amazing, because he had to stop halfway through, go kick some ass in Spain, and then come back. So it's just sheer staggering the amount of work he gets done. Obviously, he has a lot of help, but he literally drove himself. And I think he worked harder than Pompey ever would have if Pompey had won the Civil War. But that's just my take on that.
And, you know, there are questions that will be asked during the course of this episode about did he have a plan? Did he know what he was doing?
Right.
I mean, and I think that how hard and how fast he worked indicates to me that he knew exactly what he wanted to get done.
Ah.
I mean, and see, we always know Caesar didn't fuck around. I mean, that was his basic motto. That was his middle name. Right. Julius, don't fuck around. Gaius Julius, don't fuck around Caesar. I mean, he had plans. He thought That's shit right. through. Yes, yeah. Look, occasionally he would go to England without having prepared, or he'd sail to Egypt or Africa without really knowing where he was going to land. But more often than not, we've always said Caesar had a plan. He had a backup plan for his backup plan for his backup plan.
That's right. Methodical.
Now,
and he might wing it on the battlefield, but he's not going to wing it with the fate of Rome. That's just not the way he operates.
Now, it turns out it's actually hard to be absolutely clear about which laws were created by Caesar or which were created by Octavian.
Mm-hmm.
Because when Octavian was adopted, his full name was Caius Julius Caesar Octavianus.
Right.
And any law passed by him before he becomes Augustus would have been known as Lex Julia, as was any law passed by Caesar. So hard to know exactly who signed it into law. Because Caesar was assassinated so early that a lot of the things that he had put into motion weren't put into place by the time of his death, and some of them Octavian might have brought to fruition, while in other cases he would have had his own ideas, but they all would have been known as Lex Julia. So a little bit confusing.
Muddled. Now, if you want to jump into it now, I mean, some people say that he had no overall plan. It's like, well, I didn't really plan on the Civil War. I was forced into crossing the Rubicon because I wasn't willing to give up my dignitas. And it took me 3.5 years, but I won. I was so busy winning the Civil War, I didn't think about what would come after. So some historians say he had no overall plan. Some historians say he was so busy looking at short-term gains, trying to fix Rome's the way it works with its provinces, with its potential enemies outside of the provinces, that he spent so much time dickering with that he didn't even have time for an overall plan. And then there's what Cam and I were talking about, that he knew what he was doing, but first he had to clean house before he could move to something like a modified monarchy, because Rome as a government, as a system, everything but culturally, it was broken and had to be fixed, and maybe it couldn't be put back together exactly the way it was for a lot of different reasons. So maybe a modified form of monarchy was needed, and he was just the person to do it. What would happen after he died, that's for later. So the real question is, what exactly was going on in his mind during this time, not in Spain? What is his true ultimate goal? And unfortunately, we'll never know completely.
But again, as I say, like if we look at everything we know about this guy over the last 37 episodes, you know, the guy was a planner. He was an organizer. He was brilliant in his ability to plan and organize. As you say, he had been negotiating treaties between states. He'd been organizing all of Gaul. He'd organized the governments of Egypt and Africa. Everywhere he goes,
he fixed everything. Yeah,
yeah. So it's hard for me to imagine that during all of this, like during the 10 years in Gaul, when his plan was to go back and be consul again in Rome, he wasn't thinking, you know what, when I get back to Rome, like during his downtime in the winter months in particular, he's thinking, all right, so let me just make a list. What are the things that I want to get done when I'm consul again in Rome?
Yeah, right.
It's like the bride's list in Kill Bill. He's just, you know, things, top 10 things that I want to do when I'm next consul of Rome. And then, of course, when he doesn't get to be consul and the civil war starts, even though, yes, he's busy and he's fighting and all that kind of stuff, there's got to be time when he's, even if he's just sitting on the can, and, you know, he's playing Angry Birds for a while, and then he thinks, all right, let me think for a second. If I win, if I survive this civil war, and if I win, what am I going to do?
Yeah. Like, what happens?
Maybe he didn't have it planned out to the nth degree. Maybe he didn't write, you know, a 50-page mission statement.
Mission statement.
Yeah, or a 50-page business plan. I just handed in a marketing strategy to a client last night that was 63 pages long that I wrote.
Damn.
And maybe he didn't go into that amount of detail, but maybe it was at least a back of the envelope. Here are the things that I'm going to do when I'm the big man in Rome and I get rid of all of my enemies.
Right. So this doesn't happen at the very least. So this doesn't happen again. Yeah.
Yeah. And yeah, like we got to fix shit because, you know, it's
Marius and Sulla and now me. This shit's got to end or Rome's going to be destroyed.
I don't know about you, but I think Caesar was very, very smart guy. I think he was a very, very effective leader of men. I think he was an effective administrator. And again, like, you know, I hate making the analogy all the time, but a lot like Napoleon. Like he was, you know, I always used to say in the Napoleon show that Napoleon thought he was the smartest guy in France. Probably thought he was the smartest guy in Europe when it came to governing and administrating and the battlefield. And he was probably right. I mean, he was. He was the most brilliant guy in the room. And I think Caesar probably felt the same way. All right, well, look, I am the most brilliant guy in Europe. If anyone's going to fix this and it needs fixing, it's up to me. I'm going to be the guy. This is what I was born to do, was to fix the Republic.
Yeah. If I can just give that a little slant, I would think that at the very least he would say, okay, things work when I'm in charge, and right now Rome is not working, and if anybody's going to make this work, it's going to be me, and that's just the way it is. And that's not ego. That's just stating a fact from what he can see, you know, looking around at all the people in the Senate.
And I don't think it's binary like most things, right? I don't think it's black and white. I don't think it's good versus bad. Yeah, did he have selfish motives? Sure he did. I'm sure power, wealth. Also the fact that, you know, if he blinked, people were going to try and bring about his downfall. He'd known that for a long time. They'd been actively trying, his enemies, to bring about his downfall. Many of them are still alive. Many of them are still in Rome. Many of them he is forgiven and put back into positions of power.
Yeah. And he's still around.
He's not an idiot. He has to know that if he turns his back for 1 second, they're going to knife him.
Literally. But and the other thing we've said, and we stressed on several of the console shows, that it's a very competitive place. These guys are raised, you know, for the small elite coming from the noble houses. It's a very competitive business. Everybody's trying to build themselves up and tear each other down. It's what you do. Now that he's on top, it just because he worked harder than everybody else, it's normal and natural to want to outdo everybody. They don't know any different. That's what life is for them.
But I don't, yeah, and I don't think it is impossible to maintain both ideas at the same time, that he had right. selfish reasons, but also he did want to fix Rome.
Yeah, he cared about Rome, yeah.
But also, I mean, it's just when you're that kind of guy, when you get that kind of, or girl, when you're that kind of personality, fixing stuff is what you do. You make things better. You fix things. You're busy. You're smart. You know, you just fix stuff because that's in your nature. Is okay. Well, he's like an engine, a societal engineer, right? He's like, okay, well,
yeah.
Shit is broken. I can see that it's broken. I can do something about it. Let's get busy and fix it and try and make it work better. Not because I want to be remembered in 1,000 years from now as the guy that fixed Rome. Just because I can. Right, that's what I do. I fix shit, like people who fix cars or fix televisions, or you do it because you can, right?
Yeah, he's Mr. Fix-It on meth, crack, Red Bull, and who knows what else. That's just what he does. He just does it on another level that most people can't even describe to. So he's working on Rome. He's working on the social problems, the cultural problems, the problems with Rome's relationship with the provinces, but he's also got to deal with his enemies. They're still out there. Some of them still need to be pardoned or maybe killed or bribed or make sure they never come back. So he's got all this. Just imagine this guy sitting there in Rome, and he's got just everywhere he looks, there's just tons of things, decisions that have to be made that only he can make. Someone else is going to implement it because that's just how it works. But just think of the sheer stagger, the number of decisions this guy has to make every hour for the next 4 or 5 months. It would just blow most of us away. But that's why he was Caesar, because he could handle that kind of thing.
Yeah, and I get the impression that he actually loved it. He loved the work.
Yeah, you got to think, yeah.
He was good at it. I mean, you tend to love the things that you're good at, and he loved it. You know, I imagine him just working round the clock, you know, dictating 3 letters at a time, getting it all done. Even when he's banging banging Cleopatra, he's dictating letters.
But a part of him probably enjoyed it, like the fact of seeing her back, that she's going, okay, now I can get even more work done. Because it's just a part of his personality that just likes to check things off the list as he gets them done. The achiever in Caesar.
Yeah. And as you said earlier, like, he's getting old. He knows he's getting old, etc. So anyway, one of the things he does, he starts off by creating the colonization program to provide farms and property for his veterans. He's been promising them this since he was consul the first time, and he was doing it for some of Pompey's troops.
Right.
This is, you know, following through on some of the things that Sulla tried to do, but he's going to do it in a better way or a different way, providing land for
less
veterans.
Bloody.
Yeah.
And plus, he's got to, until he get rid of these guys, he's got to pay them to keep them happy. So he's got to give these guys some farmland to get them off of his back so he can try to save some money.
And also, you know, when you've got an army around, or the potential to put together an army, it's a threat as well. I mean, if somebody else comes along and offers them more bribes than you've offered them in order to turn against you, it's a threat. So he wants to get them out of Rome as quickly as possible as well. Right. So that he removes that threat and also removes the expense. He starts off by awarding public lands or properties confiscated from dead or just annoying Pompeians.
Two birds, one stone.
Yeah, but there's not enough land. So as opposed to what Sulla did, which was just confiscate, he says, no, it has to be bought at fair market rate.
Mm-hmm. Looking out for Rome. Yep, Rome's best interest.
Yeah. So he's buying land to give to the veterans.
Yeah, so I guess he did as much as he could in Italy, and it just wasn't enough, like you were saying. So he's got to look for land in North Africa and Transalpine Gaul. As far as we can tell, Narbo was enlarged. But I just thought it was amazing that I mean, this is a lot of work. You gotta, you know, you gotta find out exactly where the land's at. You gotta plot it out. Who's the real owner? That kind of stuff. But I did not know before I read this. Not only was he getting rid of the soldiers who had served him the longest, but he started doing it for citizens as well. I had no idea that was coming. I mean, you got to think that parts of Rome is a cesspit. You know, just so many people around. The conditions are bad, and he ends up getting rid of. He ends up moving, relocating tens of thousands of civilians. Again, taking care of Rome physically. Basically, the city itself, its soul, its people, just trying to move some of these people out. And it's almost like he's trying to create a whole class of farmers. Either they're middle class or trying to make sure there's more food producers for the good of Rome because the population is growing, except for the 1.2 million people that he killed. But again, he is looking out for Rome and on as many different levels as he possibly can.
Sorry.
That's fine.
Yeah. Yeah. So, 80,000 people.
Not soldiers. Damn.
Citizens.
Yeah.
I got to be resettled out of Rome. And he took this seriously as he takes everything Caesar. He's sending out surveyors. Right. Out to North Africa, Transalpine Gaul, across Italy, making sure the right amount of land is attributed to the right people. And even is open to pleas from interested parties.
Yeah.
Like Cicero asked him not to create a colony in an area of Epirus, where right. Alexander the Great's mother, Olympias, was from, mm-hmm. because a friend of his owned an estate there. And he's like,
don't mess with my stuff.
You know, it's just gonna it's gonna bring down the market, and it's blah blah blah. And Caesar right. goes, all right, sure,
because he can understand that kind of thing. Yeah, so he's open to that. Now, I thought it was interesting. When we were talking about what is Caesar's overall goal, overall plan, some people were thinking that he's like Sulla, he's very conservative, but I disagree with that. I mean. Is he trying to take care of Rome? Yes, but he's not just taking care of the rich people. He's going to end up trying to help the poorest of the poor, the people in the middle. He's going to try to enlarge the middle class, if you will. So these are more very populare moves, not conservative. Is it going to help Rome? Yes, but that doesn't automatically make it a conservative gesture or law that he's putting forward. And even though the people that still can't stand the sight of this man, they love to see a knife in his back, most of them have to admit when they're staying calm and rational that a lot of the stuff that he's doing is good. They're good plans, and it's good for Rome. Is it good for Caesar? Hell yes. But it's just they're good plans, and they're faulting the person and not his ideas or his plans.
Yeah, as we've said before, they just hated him because.
Yeah,
it was just him. Because. Yeah. And
just
because.
Because
he was competent and he got shit done. Mm-hmm. And, you know, people, inferior people tend to hate effective people who can get shit done. That you know, it's easier to justify. Yeah, it's easier to justify your lack of accomplishment by slagging off people who get out there and work hard and try and get something done. Now, I mentioned that spreading the soldiers all over the place removed a source of threat to Caesar himself, but of course, what it also did was sort of secure. A lot of these remote regions, instead of having to have garrisons everywhere, which is expensive, you can just put retired veterans all over the place. It's spreading Rome's control of these regions to a point much easier, I guess, if there is any rebellion by the local natives to pull together a on-the-spot garrison if you've got veteran soldiers, you know, 1,000 of them living there.
Yeah, they might have gray hair, but they're experienced soldiers. And so Caesar can carry out the threat that Pompey made, whereas he can stamp his foot and raise an army almost anywhere because he's purposefully putting collections of soldiers all over the place. Mm. Very brilliant move.
He also has plans to drain the Pomptine marshes to provide new farmland for poor citizens and to alter the course of the Tiber to prevent flooding. These didn't get off the ground before he died, but, you know, he was thinking. He had big, big, big visions.
Yeah, that's just the scope and scale of most of us would go, hey, you know what? It's the Tiber. It is the way it is, and when it floods, just deal with it. He's like, no, we're going to take control of it. We are going to control the Mother River or Tiber, whatever you want to call it. I just thought it was amazing. Now, go ahead.
No, you go.
I just thought
I'll play harmonica a bit while you talk.
There you go, right ahead. The number of people that he had to thank. Now you got the, okay, I can hear you, so I can't thank. The soldiers you pay, the citizens you pay, you move some people away. But as far as the more high-ranking people, money isn't enough. They're not in this for the money, because a lot of them probably had money or came from money or could get money. These people want to further the reputation of their family or their family line or the family name. They want to be rewarded politically. And he's got so many people that he has to thank for all the people that have helped him. He comes up with some, to my mind, some pretty almost silly, ridiculous things as far as just trying to cram in all these people and so they can have their names in history books. We've forgotten most of them by now, but it's some pretty, pretty funny stuff that he tries to do to thank everyone that he possibly can before and after Spain.
Yeah, and you know, you can't solve problems necessarily always with money. You know what they say about having more money? More money, Ray?
No problem.
Who sell out in the stores? You tell me who flop. Who cop the blue drop? Who jewels got pops? Who mostly Gucci down to the blue drop? The same old pimp, Mace. You know ain't nothing changed but my limp. Can't stop till I see my name on a blimp. Guarantee a million shells for the level up. You don't believe in Harlem World, nigga, double up. We don't play around, it's a bet, lay it down. Niggas didn't know me 91, bet they know me now. I'm the young Harlem nigga with the Goldie sound. Can't no PhD, niggas hold me down. School me to the game, now I know my duty. Stay humble, stay low, blow like booty. True pimp, nigga, spend no dough on the booty. When you yell, there go Mace, there go your cutie. All the spots, rock all the rocks, cop all the drops. I know you're thinking now when all the ball stops. Nigga never home, gotta call me on the yacht. 10 years from now, we'll still be on top. Yo, I thought I told you that we won't stop. Now what you gonna do when it's cool that got money much longer than yours? And a team.
Anyway, shout out to Biggie.
A very colorful political treatise, if you will, about the cultural and economic problems facing the young. I know I'm making the shit up as I go along, but anyway.
We miss you, Biggie.
I like that.
So
we miss you.
The soldiers get the land. The officers
yes.
get rewarded with new magistracies.
Nice.
He increases the number of praetors from 8 to 10, which probably makes sense because Rome's boundaries are a lot bigger now
yeah.
than they were when
yeah.
Sulla increased it to 8.
Right.
Several decades ago. Now, the Senate has granted Caesar the right to appoint magistrates.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But he didn't like just out and out appoint them. He was sending recommendations.
Quote, unquote, recommendations,
yeah, recommendations
to the Senate. I think you should get Bill and Ted and Bob. They seem like good guys. What do you think, Senate?
Yeah, actually, that it said Caesar the dictator to whatever the name of the tribe is. I commend right. to you such and such to hold the dignity of office by your vote.
Aww.
Caesar the dictator. That's how I want to start my letters. Cameron the
yeah.
dictator recommends that you shut the fuck up right now.
But Caesar, I mean, he went into overdrive. So Sulla had the praetors raised to 8, and then Caesar has it raised to 10. But when he gets back from Spain, he has like 14 praetors and 40 quaestors. And then he's got 16 praetors and another 40 quaestors in 44 BC, which we're going to go to. So he is, even though these guys are just standing around staring at each other, well, what do we do? I don't know. What do you want to do? I don't know. What should we do? You know, there's just more people than there are crap to do. He's literally thanking them, so now they're on their way up the cursus honorum, up the ladder, hopefully towards consulship, which won't mean a hell of a lot considering all the things that are about to happen in Rome.
There's this great story. I mean, it's jumping ahead a little bit, but you've already mentioned when he gets back from Spain in October 45, he resigned his consulship, and he has
yeah.
His legates, Fabius and Trebonius, Fabius,
mm-hmm.
elected consuls for the remainder of the year. So it's October, right?
Yeah.
So there's a few months left in the year. He has them appointed consuls on the last day of the year, the morning. On the morning of the last day of the year, which would have been February because the year started in March, Fabius dies.
And dies.
And so Caesar has a guy called Caius Caninius Rebilus elected consul for the remainder of the day.
Woo!
And Cicero,
I'm in history books, Mom.
Afterwards, Cicero said, fucking Cicero, man. In the consulship of Caninius, nobody ate lunch. However, nothing bad occurred while he was consul, for his vigilance was so incredible that throughout his entire consulship, he never even went to sleep.
Fact. True story. Funny, and then he laid down the arms.
He's a funny, funny fucker, that Cicero, man. Isn't he? Stand-up comic Cicero, ladies and gentlemen.
Ba-dum-boom. But, of course, all those appointments, you've got to think it deludes the meaning, the majesty, the whatever of the offices, various offices. But Caesar is just like everything else, just trying to fly through all this stuff because there's more waiting for him, and he's just trying to thank everybody he knows he has to thank, either as in thank you or you're still against me, but let me do this for you, and maybe you won't be against me after I've made you consul or praetor or something like that. So he knows what he's doing.
He grants consular status to 10 former praetors who never even were consuls.
Just skip right over that. Skip right over it.
Yeah. So it's like naming somebody had been president even though they'd never been president. It's like you can call yourself an ex-president. All the perks that come with being an ex-president.
Mr. President, yeah, I like that.
Yeah, they get the library, they get the jet, they get the staff, they get the income for life, the whole thing. They get the interns who blow them, but they didn't actually have to do it. He goes, sure. He was running out of things to give people, so he goes, like crazy shit, man.
And here's the best part. Because of the powers given to him by the Senate, this may have been tacky. It was certainly unprecedented, but it was not illegal. Just bad form.
Yeah.
But it was not illegal.
Again, in October 45, when he gets back from Spain, he has 40 quaestors elected, even though they're only going to serve till the end of the year, when another 40 are going to be elected.
That's right.
It's like, you can do it for a couple of months. I mean, that's right. all I got to give you. I mean, at least you can put that on your CV that you did that.
That's right.
Oh, and all quaestors were automatically enrolled as senators, which means the number of the senators goes up significantly. He's making senators left, right, and center. You know, I mean, some had obviously been lost during the Civil War, but he appoints hundreds. The number goes up. Well, Sulla had already doubled the size of the Senate from 300 to 600. By the time Caesar dies, it's somewhere between 800 and 900 senators.
Yeah. Now, I wish I could tell you these were all serious, somber, dedicated men, and they were divided into committees, and they all worked very, very hard. Alas, not exactly true. The Senate did not meet as much as they should have, but Caesar was using formal and informal men and some senators and ignoring a lot of them to get all the shit done. So there's a lot more senators running around, but the Senate's not meeting as much as it did, and they're certainly not doing anything because he is having his own little informal groups make things happen, because that's really the only way to get anything done. When you have such a large body, they're not going to get stuff done. He has to ignore all that and cut through all the crap.
How many senators are there in the United States, Ray?
There's 100 senators and 300 and what is it? And I'm drawing a blank now. 335, 345 House of Representatives.
Yeah. So all up. You know, so 400 and let's say, actually 535 all up. 100 senators, 435 representatives.
There we go, it was all.
Caesar had double that.
Yeah, and they weren't doing anything.
And it's, well, like, you know, the US Congress doesn't do anything either. But, I mean, his population wasn't 330 million either.
Exactly.
You
know? Yeah,
crazy number. But again, he's just giving out things left, right, and center to keep people happy. Some of the people that he brought in to the Senate had been banned. They were families that had been banned because they were close to Marius. So he's righting old wrongs. Interestingly, others are from Gaul. He's, you know, bringing in some of these Frenchies and making them citizens and giving them positions in the Senate.
Yeah. Like,
now, that's an interesting idea, isn't it? Like, you know, is that broadening Rome's understanding of its territories, could you say? I mean, is that a is that a good thing or a bad thing, do you think?
It's a good thing because Marius got in trouble when he took three citizens from up north and made them Roman citizens. He took three people and made them Roman citizens. He got in trouble for three. And this is where Caesar is not only making them citizens, he's making them senators. I mean, they're automatically, you know, on the senatorial rank. So it's a chance for the Senate to get new blood. It's a chance for the people of Gaul to see, if you will, the might and majesty of Rome so they can go home and say, don't fuck with Rome. But at the same time, it's a chance for Romans to get to know these people because these people weren't, you know, big dreadlocks and big beards and half naked or wearing deer skins or whatever. These are people, they were pretty safe choices. These were people whose family or maybe tribe had been pretty loyal to Rome over the years. They spoke Latin. They weren't all that different from the people in Rome. It's just that they weren't technically Romans and they weren't Roman citizens. So in some ways it wasn't a big deal, but because of the snobbery of the Roman Senate, it was a very big deal. But I just see it as a good thing to mix everybody up.
Well, you know, if you're going to try and if you're going to increase the borders and then you're going to try and stop future rebellions, rather than having Romans go over there and keep the peace, it makes sense to get some of the native tribal leaders, bring them into the fold.
The acceptable ones,
Yeah, and then they can, you know, they are then responsible for keeping Gaul at peace rather than Romans having to do it.
That's smart.
Now, obviously, you mentioned that the patricians of Rome aren't very happy about all of this. And part of the problem with all of this is all of these people that Caesar's appointing are obviously loyal to Caesar. So he's ending up with a Senate that is increasingly subservient to him, to his desires, to his needs. It's not an independent body anymore. Mm-hmm. Now it's just a bunch of increasingly sycophants who are going to rubber stamp everything that Caesar wants done. And, you know, the old guard are obviously genuinely concerned about how Rome is sliding further and further into, you know, the monarchical rule of one man. Yeah. There was graffiti on the forum, apparently, that said it would be a good idea not to give the new senators directions to the Senate. Obviously suggesting that they've never been to Rome before. They don't even know where the Senate is, but they're senators. But if you just don't tell them how to get there, they'll never turn up.
I like that.
Now, Cicero, there's an interesting quote from Cicero. He says, even if he wishes the Commonwealth to be as perhaps he too would like it to be, and as we must all want it to be, he has still not done what he could do, so deeply has he involved himself with many people. And my translation of that is that Cicero kind of recognized that Caesar had indebted himself to so many people over the last couple of decades, and he had to pay back all of these IOUs, all of these favors, all of these promises that he'd made to so many people that even if he genuinely wanted to tighten up Rome and make it run better and reform it genuinely, he was kind of hampered because he had to pay back all these people and in doing so, you know, maybe increase the level of complexity rather than simplifying matters.
Yeah, the means are screwing up the ends. Yeah. Now, did you do any research on Sallust? I didn't have a chance, but I was curious by the way the authors just kind of touched on him. Did he get in some trouble? I know he was left back in North Africa to try to govern or straighten things out after the Battle of Thapsus. But did you get a sense of what trouble he got into or maybe appeared to get into in North Africa?
Yeah, well, just that he was made governor of Africa after Thapsus. And he was accused of being brutal and oppressive while he was in the position of power. He later denied it in his writings, as you would.
Sure.
But, you know, this is the common story, right, of these governors. They were all brutal.
Yeah.
And, I mean,
greedy and, yeah.
Sallust may have been an historian, but does that mean he was morally superior to everybody else? Probably not.
Right. It should, but probably not.
Yeah, he was in a position of power. There was corruption rampant in these things. He was probably trying to enrich himself and is quite possibly just as brutal as most of the guys in those positions had been through the years.
Yeah, but Caesar,
I was going to say, Caesar was criticized and is criticized by historians and was criticized at the time and later on by Plutarch and Suetonius and Pliny and these guys for, you know, the lack of moral fiber, let's say, of the people he appoints into positions of power. Because a lot of them did dodgy things, like even Sallust. But, you know, Caesar, I think at one point says something like he would have even supported thieves and murderers if they had supported him in his cause. But, you know, what the more serious charge is that by increasing the size of the Senate, it made it impossible for any debate to happen. Imagine trying to get agreement from 900, and they all want to have their speech. They all want to give their speech about a bill. I mean, just nothing's going to happen. So in reality, Caesar is actually making the decisions, of course, and then getting the Senate to rubber stamp them. And then even that, he's creating, you know, they're faking the records to say it had been debated by the Senate.
Right.
And that the Senate had voted this way or that way, even creating fake lists of attendees at the debates.
Damn.
And Cicero claims he received letters from communities thanking him for voting in their favor on a particular issue. And he wrote that he'd never even heard of them or their cause before. But again, as you mentioned before, like even Caesar's harshest critics don't accuse him of making bad decisions or passing bad legislation at this period, even though he was faking the process of the Senate debates. Most of the decisions that he was making, most of the reforms were, you know, good. He was doing a good job, even if he was doing it, you know, in an improper fashion.
What I liked was even the fake participation of the Senate was pretty much the limit. So he'd come up with a law, he'd have the Senate supposedly rubber stamp voted, but then he wouldn't have, it wasn't like committees of senators would carry it out. He was like Franklin Delano Roosevelt. He had independent non-senators like Oppius and Balbus carry out his policies or make sure it got done. You know, they would delegate it. So Senate is literally rubber stamping, but they're not even implementing. So they are literally just a figurehead. He's getting all the work done. It was probably for the best, let's face it. But for whatever reason, he was keeping as much of it out of the Senate's hands as he possibly could, but at least things were getting done.
Yeah, he didn't have a lot of time. He knew he had to get to Spain, finish off Labienus.
Yeah.
Now, speaking of Cicero, he was, of course, one of the many Pompeians who had been pardoned and sat now in the Senate. And he had resolved when he came back to Rome not to take part in any politics, but just to devote himself to writing about the Roman Constitution and, being an academic. Now, Brutus had also been pardoned at this stage. As we remember, after Pharsalus, Caesar went looking for him and was happy to find him alive. He'd been sent by Caesar to govern Cisalpine Gaul.
Right.
Even though he hadn't held any magistracy, you know, normally before you went to be a governor, you had to have been consul.
Edile, consul.
He hadn't done any of that, but Caesar just doesn't fuck. Go, just go do it. We won't tell.
Yeah, I'm banging your mom. I banged your young sister, Tertia. Just you've earned it, or they've earned it for you. Just go.
And you're probably my illegitimate kid, so you know.
So I love you. Just go.
Cassius had been pardoned. And he had accepted a post as a legate. And there were other Pompeians who had stopped fighting,
right,
but hadn't formally surrendered to Caesar, so couldn't return to Italy. So they were still in exile, and one of them was Marcus Claudius Marcellus. We mentioned him, you know, many times before. Remember, he was the he was the consul in 51 BCE. He hated Caesar. Had helped.
I'm still pissed at him.
He had helped start the civil war by trying to recall Caesar from Gaul. He was the guy who flogged the magistrate from Novum Comum. Remember, Caesar makes this guy something or other.
Says, at the least a citizen, and you can't touch a citizen's back.
Sends him to Rome, and Marcellus has him flogged. And
I was just going to say, and Marcellus is the one who offered Pompey a sword. Like, here, you know, lead us, that kind of thing. So just a real dick, and he wants to come back.
I don't know. That wasn't this one.
That wasn't him? Oh, that was one of, that's right, because there were like three of them, wasn't there? Yeah. I'm sorry.
And I wrote that in my notes, and then I went, And then I spent like hours the other night trying to figure out again which one was which and who. I think that was Caius Claudius.
Oh, that's right, But so he wants to come back, but he's not going to ask Caesar, but he has other people ask Caesar for him. What a dick. I'm sorry. What a dick.
Now, putz. But he's in exile. So upon the start of the Civil War, Marcellus joined up with the Optimates. He was in the Republican Grand Army in Epirus. After the Battle of Pharsalus, he kind of withdraws from the battle, but goes to Mytilene on the island of Lesbos. Now.
How much fighting was done there?
None. Well, I don't know what he was fighting, but I got to talk about Lesbos. You know that we have to go down this rabbit hole.
Please.
If I was going to go into exile,
right?
I mean, the island where lesbians come from, that's where I'm going into exile.
Boom.
Well, yes. I don't know. As long as they're like, you know, lipstick lesbians and they'll let me watch, at least, if not participate. Now, the word lesbian, Ray, you probably know it. It has something to do with the island of Lesbos. Most people do. But do you know why? Do you know why we associate the island of Lesbos with lesbian?
No, please. I want to learn something.
Well, I shall be happy to educate you. I was watching all this lesbian porn the other night, and Chrissy was
research.
Yeah, Chrissy was like, what the fuck? You're sitting right next to me. And I'm like, it's research for the show. I mean, I have to really understand what's going on here.
She probably got mad when you asked for her credit card, but go ahead.
Sappho was a Greek lyric poet, a woman, born on the island of Lesbos. The Alexandrians included her in the list of 9 lyric poets. She was a big fucking deal. Yeah. She was born somewhere between 630 and 612 BCE, is said to have died around 570 BCE. Little is known about her life, but her poetry centers on passion and love for various people of both sexes. She was bi, not lesbian, but, you know.
Yeah.
So the word lesbian derives from her poetry talking about love of women. But interestingly enough, the word lesbian wasn't applied to female homosexuality until the 19th century, the mid-19th century, like the 1850s or something. Before then, a lesbian was just somebody from the island of Lesbos. You can say a Lesbosian, but they were lesbians. They were from the island of Lesbos. Right. The words that they used for girl-on-girl loving before then was either sapphic, because of Sappho, or tribadism, tribadism comes from the Greek word to rub.
Ah.
Tribadi, I think, or something like that.
Gotcha.
To rub.
That's cool.
So the 3rd century philosopher Maximus of Tyre wrote that Sappho was small and dark, and that her relationships to her female friends were similar to those of Socrates, before we get all judgy on her. Right. He wrote, what else could one call the love of the lesbian women than the Socratic art of love? For they seem to me to have practiced love after their own fashion, she the love of women, he of boys. For they said they loved many and were captivated by all things beautiful. When Alcibiades and Charmides and Phaedrus were... What Alcibiades and Charmides and Phaedrus were to him, i.e. mm-hmm. Socrates... Right. Gyrinna and Attis and Anactoria were to her.
Ah.
So unfortunately, we don't call male homosexuality Socratic love. It would have a completely different spin.
Yeah.
If you said, oh, yeah, they're Socratic. They're Socratic.
I could respect that. Yeah,
yeah. Now, in part of my research, I came across the art of Edouard Henri Avril.
Is that the stuff you put on Facebook?
Uh-huh.
You got my attention.
Did you damn quick
with that.
You got, if those of you that aren't on Facebook, first of all, why the fuck not? Why do you torment us by not joining
there.
Our Life of Caesar Facebook page? Torment yes. us. There are, you know, tens and tens and tens of thousands of you listening to this and only a couple of thousand people on our Facebook page. Like, come on.
Get your ass on Facebook.
Anyway, you're missing out because this guy was like mid-19th century artist, painter, and he painted a lot of very fucking out there erotic stuff for books. He was like, if you were doing the 19th century equivalent of a porn novel, you'd right. go to Edouard Henri Avril, or I think Paul Avril was his stage name, to do paintings and illustrations for the book. Now, he did his magnum opus was a book. I can't remember what it's called, but it was written by somebody else. It's a collection of all of the sexual practices of ancient Greece and Rome, and Avril mm-hmm. did highly realistic paintings.
Yeah.
I mean, and the one
I learned some things.
Yeah, there's one of a guy fucking a goat holding on to its horns.
That's not what I learned.
Yeah, like how do you reach that far to grab the horns? Everyone knows you just grab it by the haunches. Plus, you need a hand to get the tail out of the way. I mean,
it's complicated.
But there are paintings of men fucking men, a guy fucking a guy in the ass while the other guy fucks a woman. There are lesbian, lots of lesbian stuff, women going down on each other. There are lesbian mermaids going down on each other.
I kind of like that.
There is everything. Like if you can, like I saw stuff in these paintings I haven't even seen in porn. I mean, there was no scat, I have to say that. But there was no two-girl, one-cup painting, but I was genuinely amazed that existed.
That. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, in the 19th century, mid-19th century, this guy was painting the most hardcore erotica, like super, super fucking hardcore stuff of every persuasion. But anyway... We can't talk about lesbians without a song, and I picked this version because it's better than the later version.
Here we go.
You know this one?
Not yet.
Jenny came over and told me about Fred. He's such a hairy behemoth, she said. Dumb as a box of hammers, but he's such a handsome guy. And I opened up and I told her about Larry and how he asked me to marry, and I'm not giving him an answer yet. I think I can do better. So we left, compared notes. We had a drink, we had a smoke. She took off her overcoat. I kissed a girl. She called home to say she'd be late. He said he worried, but now he feels safe. I'm glad you're with your girlfriend. Tell her hi for me. And then I looked at you, you had guilt in your eyes, but it only lasted a little while. And then I felt your hand above my knee.
Oh entendre. The original I Kissed a Girl by Jill Sabouli.
Wow.
From 1995. Wow. Fuck Katy Perry's version. That's the best version for my money. Anyway, back to Marcellus.
Yes.
he's Woo. he's on the island of Lesbos looking for some action.
Hold on, let me look at my Fitbit and see what my heart rate is. Hold on. Okay, yeah. Okay, go ahead.
He as you say, he refuses to write to Caesar directly. What a dick. So, but he gets Caesar's father-in-law, Piso,
yeah.
And his own cousin, Caius Claudius Marcellus Minor, who was married to Caesar's great niece, Octavia, Octavian's sister, to put in a good word for him. And then, as we mentioned many episodes ago, Cicero delivers his pro Marcello speech. I read part of that, I think, in a Consul show where we were talking about Cicero.
Sounds right.
I'm not going to read it again, but, you know, Caesar finally consents to Marcellus coming back to Rome. But unfortunately for Marcellus, before he gets there, he's murdered by one of his own staff for being a dick. One of his servants is like, you couldn't even write to Caesar yourself and apologize. Right. Fuck you. I've had enough of you.
And stabbed him. Yeah.
So then Cicero gives another speech. You know, again, and so Cicero was not going to get involved in politics, but now he is getting involved in politics is the point of this.
Balls deep now, Well, and it's interesting that he's giving speeches for the Pompeians. He's not backing Caesar. He's not going around. Everybody vote for Caesar or whatever. He is literally making jokes about Caesar, like the guy who was consul for a day or whatever. Cicero is still, his feelings are still hurt and he's still being a dick about it. But I think Caesar is... I think Caesar knows what Cicero is doing, and he's allowing it to a certain degree because he's trying to bring the family, if you will, back together in Rome.
Yeah, yeah. And like in the Marcello speech, Pro Marcello, he goes over the top singing Caesar's praises and talking about what a god amongst men Caesar is. And then in the Pro Ligario speech, so there's this other guy, Quintus Ligarius, who, you know, was a Pompeian. He'd been forgiven by Caesar of Pharsalus, but had rejoined the Pompeians in Africa. And, you know, we know that Caesar doesn't look too favorably upon people that have, you know, you get a
Can't
second chance, but not a third chance, says Caesar. There's a guy called Tubero, who was himself a commander under Pompey, but who submitted to Caesar after Pharsalus, and he's kind of pissed at Ligarius for rejoining the Pompeians, maybe because it makes him look bad, maybe because he's trying to curry favor with Caesar by slagging off Ligarius. Anyway, Tubero's trying to convince Caesar to have Ligarius either exiled or assassinated.
Mm-hmm.
And Cicero gives this speech. It's called the Pro Ligario, and I've got some excerpts from it that, with your leave, Ray, I'd like to read.
Yeah, just real quick, Caesar said he had already made up his mind. He was not going to allow Quintus to come back, but he would like to hear Cicero speak just because it was such a treat and a pleasure to hear Cicero speak.
Yeah, you gotta love that. Yeah. I don't care what you're going to say, but it's just so much fun to hear you talk because you're such a clever fucker. I'm not going to do anything about it, but knock yourself out. So there's some excerpts. It's quite long, so I'm not going to read the whole thing. But he says, "Who is there, I ask, who alleges Ligarius to have been in fault because he was in Africa? He does so who himself was most anxious to be there and now complains that he was refused admittance by Ligarius, he who was in arms against Caesar." So, background story here. So, Tubero did submit to Caesar after Pharsalus, but then he gets sent to Africa, tries to get there, but Ligarius won't let him land. Even though one of his kids is on the boat and he's sick, but Ligarius says, no, you... you submitted to Caesar, so you can't land here. You're the enemy. So Tubero's kind of pissed still at Ligarius for not... because he had a sick kid on his boat, among other things. Anyway, back to Cicero. "What was your sword doing, Tubero, in that Pharsalian army? Whom did you seek to kill then? What was the meaning of your weapon? What was it that you desired so eagerly with those eyes and hands, with that passion in your heart? I press him too much. The young man seems to be disturbed. I will speak of myself then, for I also was in that army. But what was our aim to Burrow, if it was not that we might win the power that he has won? It is then, Caesar, the very men whose enjoyment of indemnity wins you your title to clemency, who by their eloquence would sting you into cruelty. I will speak without reserve what I feel, Caesar. If in the greatness of your fortunes, the clemency in which you purposely, yes, purposely persist, and I realize what I am saying, had not been equally great, then your triumph would be overwhelmed in a flood of bitter mourning. How many of the victors would there be who would have you pitiless, since such are found even among the vanquished? How many would be those who, wishing that none should be pardoned by you, would raise barriers against your mercy when even those whom you yourself have pardoned? Nice. And here's the final verses from the speech. That therefore, which in the case that though that... Let me start again. That therefore, which in the case of that most noble and most illustrious man, Marcus Marcellus, you lately did in the Senate House, do now also in the Forum with respect to these most virtuous brothers, who are so highly esteemed by all the crowd here present. As you granted him to the Senate, so grant this man to the people, whose affections you have always considered most important to you. And if that day was one most glorious to you, and at the same time most acceptable to the Roman people, do not, I entreat you, do not hesitate to earn the praise of a glory like that as frequently as possible. For there is nothing so calculated to win the affections of the people as kindness. Of all your many virtues, there is none more admirable, none more beloved than your mercy. For there is no action by which men make a nearer approach to the gods than by conferring safety on others. Fortune has no greater gifts for you than when it bestows on you the ability. Nature has no better endowment for you than when it bestows on you the will to save as many people as possible. The cause of my client, perhaps, requires a longer speech than this. A shorter one would certainly be sufficient for a man of your natural disposition. Wherefore, as I think it more desirable for you to converse, as it were, with yourself than for me or anyone else to be speaking to you, I shall now make an end. This only will I remind you of, that if you do grant this protection to him who is absent, you will be giving it also to all these men who are here present. And according to Plutarch, Caesar was so emotionally overcome, his body shook and some documents fell from his hand, and so under compulsion, he acquitted Ligarius.
Nice.
And what did Ligarius do to return the favor?
Please tell me something nice.
He was one of the assassins who stabbed Caesar a year later.
Sorry. What a dick.
Cicero, now, I mean, apart from the eloquence of Cicero's speech, which I butchered with my bad recitation, but the way that he talks to Caesar in both the Pro Marcello and the Pro Ligario speeches, it's like he's addressing a king. He's not addressing, right, you know, an equal here. He's talking about him like he is a monarch, yeah, like it's his mercy, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, it's just strange that, I don't know.
Yeah, when you were reading that, I could just picture Cicero walking towards Caesar, looking him right in the eye and say, the more kind you are, the more like a god you are, oh great Caesar. And how would that not stroke an ego or pacify someone? You know, just, I mean, he put it a lot better than that, but how does that not get to you? You know, it gets under your armor.
But I don't know, again, like, it can't have been good for the perception of Caesar to be talked to like this by a guy like Cicero. I mean, I remember when I read the Pro Marcello speech many, many moons ago, and I was talking about, was he taking the piss when he was building up Caesar so much? Was he, like, laying it on so heavy that right. he was.
That was the impression we got.
Yeah. And still here, like, I don't know. I mean, we don't have any record. We actually have copies of Cicero's actual speech that Cicero had in his letters or whatever to Atticus, I think. But, you know, I kind of imagine him finishing and Caesar going, fucking cut it out, Cicero. Stop talking to me like I'm a king. I'm not
Kill
a king,
the son
right?
of a bitch now.
I'm a dictator. I'm just trying to get shit under control. Stop, you know, acting like I'm this fucking.
But he didn't.
Well, we don't know. We don't have any record.
We don't
that
really
he did.
Know. That's true. That's true.
Yeah, but Ligarius, becomes one of the assassins. You know, Plutarch says that Ligarius never forgave Caesar for pardoning him.
Oh, you. Yeah.
Didn't want to be pardoned.
Then why in the...
So, was Tubero right? Should Caesar not have been forgiving these guys, particularly the guys he'd already forgiven after Pharsalus and then went to Africa? Yeah. He's forgiving him another... You know, this mercy of Caesar's, as we know, came around and bit him on the ass. People are going, don't forgive them, Caesar. Caesar's like, what are they going to do?
It's going to be okay, yeah. And that because that would have been one less dagger and stabbed into his toga. But still, I mean... A good political policy just taken way too far that ends up backfiring on him.
Well, we're over an hour, Ray.
Yeah. Yeah. Woo.
So I think we're going to wrap up episode 38 there.
Yeah.
And we've got a lot more to do in terms of Caesar's political reforms.
Yeah. But, oh, my God.
You're going to have to wait to episode 39. We're going to get into the calendar. The Julian calendar. We're getting to get into more of the colonization program.
Dole. Yeah.
Yeah. There's a lot going on here. A lot going on. And we're going to thank our new patrons and our new reviews, all of that kind of stuff. But
Thank you for listening, everybody.